Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Fantastic to see everybody. Thanks again for coming to another Word in Your Ear. This being recorded in Islington, in the Islington Pub in London's swinging N1 district. And I have to say, it is rammed to the gills. And I am not surprised, because tonight we're focusing on two groups with a strong connection, which both shone their torch on the life of the uniquely British suburbs and had a ton of hit records while they were doing it. And the first of our two authors was, and I'd like to think still is, the drummer with the Jam. And they were described here, it says, "And there isn't a rhythm section around that can touch them," declared Cub reporter Mark Ellen in the NME in 1978. I just found that review in the attic this evening. A review of the Reading Festival when they played with Sham 69, which we shall hear more of anon. So please welcome the mighty Rick Buckler. And we should just say that here it is, in fact, that Rick has a superb book out called, almost inevitably, That's Entertainment, My Life in the Jam. And so, and we're going to start, I think, were we, by talking about possibly life back in Woking and, well, here's a couple of pictures from
it. Travel back in time. These are my home scans of some of the pictures in Rick's book. I hope you'll forgive me. This is... Flavour of... Give us an idea of Woking, the Woking that you grew up in the 1950s and 60s.
Well, it was a pretty dreadful place. The Germans missed most of it, which was unfortunate. There was nothing there that was worth bombing, really. But they were knocking most of it down when I was growing up, which, thankfully, they should do. But I suppose it was unremarkable in a lot of ways. There was the usual sort of redevelopment and during the 1950s. I was born in 1955. And so by the time I sort of was, you know, the 1960s started, there was a lot of redevelopment going on there. These are three school friends, two of them, well, myself and Tony Pilot and Dave Waller, who was the original guitarist, rhythm guitarist with the Jam. But they're both dead now, unfortunately, which is a real shame. This is my mum and dad.
Tell us about your mum and dad.
My dad was a postman. He'd sort of come out of the railways after the war and joined the post office, which was a good, solid job for him in those days. Very, very, very working class.
Baptist. They went to the Baptist church, is that right?
Yeah, that's
quite
right.
Quite regular churchgoers.
Yeah. I mean, the Baptist church was just round the corner from us, and it was the only thing I really liked about it was the fact there was lots of singing going on. You know, being Baptist, that's what they do most of the time, apart from dunking each other in water all the time. I'm not religious at all. I mean, I've left no mark on me whatsoever.
What kind of music would they have been playing in the house? What did you grow up listening to in the household?
Oh, crikey. Well, not a great deal, actually. Most of the radio was the comedy shows that were on, mucking about in the whatever it was.
Much Binding in the March.
That's the one, yeah. That sort of thing used to come on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, radio was king in the late 50s and early 60s, I suppose.
So was there a record player in the house? Was there a radiogram or anything like that?
Not really. I've got a twin brother and I've got two older brothers, and they really... I used to listen to what they were listening to. So they were listening to the Beatles and the early Rolling Stones and those sort of bands. So I used to hear all that. And still to this day, every time I hear Hard Day's Night, it just reminds me of playing Skeletrix on the floor, you know what I mean? Because that was my Christmas present. And so those sort of, you know what music's like, it does invoke a lot of memories from that time that you first heard that. It was my brothers were the beatniks and growing up with skiffle and that sort of thing that I heard a lot of in my really early years.
So how did you first start getting involved in music?
At school everybody used to swap albums. Albums were still quite expensive to buy, so everybody swapped albums. And I think we started sort of hang around with a lot of people who played. There was the odd guitarist and stuff. So it was just wanted to do more than just listen to it. Wanted to play. I think I got left with, somebody had already grabbed the lead guitar. Somebody had already grabbed the bass. So there was a drum kit left. I thought, well, I better have that then. Do you know what I mean?
Are you a frustrated lead guitarist?
No. But it was sort of like that. Do you know what I mean? Just really wanting to be able to play something. And I just took to the drums straight away. I just loved that, hitting things, I suppose.
But this is just a lovely picture. I don't know if you can see that all from here. But at the top left there, that's... I think you in the middle. Is it Paul Weller on the left, I think?
Yeah.
Looking rather like a Steve Marriott. Who's that on the right?
That's Steve Brooks. He was the original guitarist.
And I love that everyone's wearing baggies, which dates it. Yeah. Would that be 73? When would that have been taken?
That was about that 70. Yeah, 73, 74.
Baggies and kipper ties.
Yeah. Oh, so we were very trendy.
Where had you bought those threads? Did you go to Harry Fenton or Take Six? I'm trying to think which were they...
No, it was Hepworth's was the big suit shop. It's nothing to do with you.
His old dad's. And RPL in the shoe shop, in fact, as well, yeah.
And a lot of it was catalogue stuff as well. You could buy clothes out of the catalogue and, you know, it didn't matter whether it fitted. It, you know, most of it was too long in the arms or the legs or something. But, yeah, there wasn't the fashion sense was pretty dreadful, I suppose.
So how did you first meet Paul Weller?
At school. This was the sort of crowd we used to hang around in the music room and swap albums with and that sort of thing. That's when Paul and Steve had a little duo, which they used to go out and play the clubs at the weekends. And I was sort of in a band with my brother and another guy, but we never left the rehearsal studio. We never left the front room practicing. In fact, this is me practicing in the bay window. Do you know what I mean?
What were you called? Is it Impulse you were called? What
was that? Yeah, Impulse, yeah.
The 70s, then.
It was, yeah. It was the 70s.
So. Exactly, of course. No reason why you shouldn't. You're absolutely right.
Well spotted.
Pauling slander there.
So Paul and, is it Steve, were a bit more outgoing and they were actually going and playing...
And they needed a drummer, and I think they had a drummer, a guy called Bomber Harris, who he decided that he was going to go on holiday rather than do the big gig that we had coming up, or that Steve and Paul had coming up with the Shearwater Youth Club. So I sort of jumped in and did that, and then stayed with them, really, from that moment onwards. But that was just a terrible, terrible show, because we hadn't really learned the songs properly. We knew how to start them, but we didn't really know how to finish them. So somebody would just sort of say, just stop, you know, right? And we'd all just grind to a halt, and then we'd do some other song, you know.
Actually, I must just mention... I was just reading this out earlier. It's so interesting. It's fascinating to find out. It gives you such an insight into what a band's like when you find out what the set list was like. I won't read out all 47 songs, but on April the 7th, at the Woking Workings Men's Club in Walton Road, I think... the group played a set that included Blue Suede Shoes, Blue Moon, Wooden Heart, O'Carroll, Save the Last Dance for Me. It's amazing. All I Have to Do is Dream, Devil in a Heart, Leaving on a Jet Plane. Isn't that fantastic? Again, very 70s. Proud Mary, 8 Days a Week, This Boy, Jailhouse Rock, Hippie Hippie Shake, Long Tall Sally, and Great Balls of Fire. I mean, I think that's really interesting. You were a covers band, like any other covers band.
Well, how we got our work, by playing all these covers and songs everybody knew. You know, I mean, most of the places that we played, people used to go to these gigs because the beer was the right price, not because they used to go and see who was playing. You know, we just happened to be just like the sideshow. So the only way that we would get any work was to play all these covers. I mean, we used to throw in a couple of our own numbers near the end when everybody was a bit tipsy. You know, they wouldn't notice the difference. We sort of loved doing it because it was a great way of playing every weekend. But you have to put up with the people sitting at the front with their fingers in their ears, you know, like turn it down and all this sort of thing.
We got a shot of the satin. We're going to ask you this. Yes, that's a very early band that Rick was in. This is actually, is it Iron Butterfly?
That's Iron Butterfly.
Yeah, because there's a lovely bit in the book where you talk about those early groups. You bought an Iron Butterfly record and you loved Atomic Rooster and Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple. And, you know, tell us a bit about all of that and its influence.
Yeah, well, because we obviously at that age, everybody's discovering music and discovering what they like or what they don't like, and people would lend their albums to each other. So those were the sort of bands that were going around. There was the Elton Johns, and one of the oddities was Atomic Rooster. But they had a great drummer with them, a guy called Paul Hammond. And he was just brilliant to listen to because you could steal all of his riffs and you think, well, I'll play that, Phil. Because he was all over the kit, all over. So he was great to listen to for that reason. So that sort of was my earliest exposure to other types of music apart from the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. Really, was what people were passing around at school, and it was those sort of bands, you know. And of course, prog rock was king at that time.
But is it quite liberating to be able to talk about that now? It's really funny because I was with the NME at that time, and you would interview the Sex Pistols and the Jam and the Banshees, and no one could admit to liking Rory Gallagher or Argent or whatever. They could only like Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, and Bowie.
They're all raised by wolves.
Raised by wolves. Yeah,
they just appeared.
Course, they were all listening to what everyone else was listening to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this was what came before. You know, I mean, it was what the whole punk thing was rebelling against. Really, was these massive bands that were playing huge arenas and
Atomic Rooster.
Well, maybe not Tommy Rooster, actually.
I think everybody got blamed for that video that ELP made of them playing Fanfare for the Common Man in an empty stadium. Yeah, everybody thought everybody's like that.
Yeah. There was a nice bit where you talk about taking the drum pattern from the beginning of Smoke on the Water and using it in Tube Station Midnight, I think it is. Was that right?
Yeah, well, you sort of think, well, you just listen to the drum patterns and stuff. So you take no notice of the rest of the song. It just, that's all I was interested in was stealing bits and pieces of what other people were doing and think, well, I'll file that away and then I'll get that out one day when I get the opportunity, you know. There's no holes barred. I mean, I'm not fussy where I was getting my influences from or anything like that, you know.
But talk us through these pictures. Now, this is a picture of the Jam at the winning post in Twickenham. What year would this have been? Playing the policeman's ball.
That's right. Yeah,
with a fantastic wall of kind of glass bricks.
It was ceramic tiles. Yeah, it was like
that's right.
It's not the toilet or anything. No. It might look like it, but it was a bit. The venue is actually still there. I think it's on the 316. It's still sitting there, this place. But yeah, we used to do things. Like policemen's balls, they just say, well, we want a band to come in and play cover songs of whatever, do you know what I mean? So we would turn up with our kipper ties and white loafers, as you can see, looking very good. But people used to introduce us as Hey Man, the Jam, okay, you know what I mean? They had no idea that Heyman was a drum kit, you know, he was the make of drum kit.
That's super. How did you get the name? Because the name was a bit of an issue, wasn't it? I mean,
it was. We couldn't think of anything better, so we thought, we'll just stick with this name for the time being. And when we think of a better name, we'll change it. We'll have a better name, you know. But we never did. We never really liked it. But it was pointed out to us that it's not really the name. It's what you make of it. It could be anything. But, you know, it's what people start to associate the name with the type of music that you play. So, and after a while, we just thought that it was the music that really spoke for it, and not really the name of the band. We were always very envious of the Clash, because we thought the Clash was a great name for a band, you know.
which brings us on to this, actually.
Yes.
Because this, you talk about in the book that the arrival in 1976 or whenever of Ramone's Sex Pistols Clash made the Jam quite envious.
Or gave you a sense of direction, wasn't it? Because you were basically playing covers, playing Chuck Berry songs, and motivated you to go off in a certain.
We'd been playing to a different audience, you know, in the CIUs and the working men's clubs, and they weren't, like I said before, they weren't there to see us in particular. They were just there because the beer was cheap. So to find that there was a scene going on in London, where, you know, the audience were the same age as us, and that they were there specifically to see those bands was really exciting for us. So that's why at that point we decided we were going to move out of Surrey and Woking and what have you and really concentrate on playing the Nashville and, the Three Kings.
And what particularly about the Ramones, top left there? I mean, what was it about the Ramones that had an impact on you?
I suppose because they were the American new wave, weren't they? They were, they was... And they played a sort of 50s style, but they'd made it their own and they brought it up to date and etc. And, you know, I suppose like most bands, you're always looking to create your own sound and so that you're identifiable. I mean, if you put on a Rolling Stones number, you know it's the Rolling Stones straight away because it's that there's something about it that's got Rolling Stones stamped all over it. And I think that's one of the things that we were searching for was our own identity. And obviously the Ramones were one of those bands that you just know a Ramones song. I mean, you know, they were really, really iconic with their sound. And the Clash had their own sound, the Pistols had their own sound. And that's what one of the things that we were, you know, we sort of strived to sort of achieve was to, you know, have an identifiable sound of our own.
Did that make you raise your game suddenly? The you know being aware of all this that was going on. Did the band suddenly get better or set itself different?
I think more than anything else, it just gave us a really clear direction about what we wanted to do. You know, in as much as that, it certainly gave Paul the incentive to actually start writing his own songs rather than doing covers. I think we'd had enough. We'd been around the clubs for 4 or 5 years doing this stuff, and we were absolutely sick and tired of that list of songs that you have there. Do you know what I mean? We were very good at doing them. That's why in later years we could quite easily pull out something like David Watts and Sweet Soul Music and just do it because we'd spent years playing that sort of stuff.
It's a lovely idea that you would see the Ramones and think, we are never playing Leaving on a Jet Plane ever again. But this is fascinating because one of the things that you took was, we've got to get some kind of look. You know, they all had their particular looks, and you'd been wearing sort of suits and ties and stuff before. But how did you arrive at that? Well, I think are actually bowling shoes, aren't they? The American bowling shoes, was that the...?
I think, actually, Elvis, during the 50s, started wearing these shoes. Yeah. I think it was something that we'd found in Carnaby Street or something.
Yeah.
They were a step up from the sort of shoes that we had before, which I couldn't play drums in because they were great big crepe soles. You know what I mean? It was like having bricks on your feet. You know what I mean? They were just awful. But at least these were getting closer to having, you know. But I think that was Oxford Street. And yes. People were just ignoring us and get out of my way. Do you know what I mean?
Almost trying to breaking into a run to get past you.
Yes.
But you had a uniform, didn't you? You had a kind of look, which lots of the bands at the time didn't have, really. You didn't have any objection to that. Nobody minded.
No.
Wearing the suits and the shoes and so forth.
No. I think it was. I mean, the original idea was to. Especially when we were playing the clubs, that we thought, right, we're going to do everything we possibly can to get noticed, so and for people sort of to remember you. So that's why we started off with white satin bomber jackets and white kipper ties, etc. So that when we all dressed the same, it was just something that we felt was going to give us an edge. That's amazing what you do when you're young, isn't it? Really, but. And it sort of led on from there. We decided we'd go for like a more sort of Beatle type suit, you know, like the early Beatles would have. But even then, that didn't really last that long. This particular period, I think, only a sort of a year and a half from 77, 78. And then we could afford to buy more clothes. We only had one of these. So when we did the States, and we did something like two shows a night. Two nights in each town, which is four shows, starting in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, and New York. By the time we got to New York, the suits could walk around on their own. I mean, they were they were absolutely soaking wet. They never got a chance to dry out. You know.
I thought Bruce had a spare pair of trousers in the wings. There's a couple of moments when he runs off stage because his toys rip the trousers by leaping spectacularly high.
Yeah, well, that was later on. Yeah. Well, I mean, to wear tight trousers was obviously a very good thing. Nobody used to notice but me. But every time I'd watch from the back, and he'd have a great split up the back of his trousers where the stitching's given way and why. He'd sidle off to have he'd have a spare pair, you know, waiting in the wings, which he'd quickly jump into between numbers. You know, I don't know. It's just that I think they were just a tad too tight at that point.
One thing. There was an age difference between you and Bruce and Paul.
Yeah, there's a year between us. So Paul was a year below us at school.
Right.
Bruce was a year above me. So
did that stay with you? That kind of age differences, they tend to be very important when you're younger.
I suppose when you're at school, you notice it more. But I mean, once we went out into the wide world, no, it didn't make any difference at all, really.
There was some issue about... Have we got the In the City sleeve? Yes, right. There's a strange story in this where you know, you kind of forget how threatening punk rock was. You know, the Sex Pistols had just vomited very publicly in Heathrow Airport or whatever, and all this kind of palaver was going on. And you had a whole lot of swear words or something on the sleeve of In the City, and the pressing plant refused to print them. Isn't that right? Was they sort of down to...
Yeah, there was... It was supposed to be an insert that went in, just a sheet of paper that was going to be put in to the In the City album, and it had some of the lyrics just ticker taped across there, you know, selection of lyrics on there. And they weren't actually that strong looking back on it. There wasn't anything on there that was too outrageous. But the women at the packing plant who used to put the albums in the sleeves and therefore the insert into there as well, Just down tools and said, we're not dealing with this rubbish. We're not having it.
What did these lyrics? What are these?
Oh, I can't remember. I think I might. I mean, the album never went out with these involved in, you know, actually in there. So the record company made the executive decision just to pull the insert completely and not pack with them in. I mean, we had to go down to the packing plant.
Yeah, you actually went to the pressing plant, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
To show them what nice young men.
Yeah, aren't we nice? Aren't we lovely? And we turned up and, you know.
We wear suits.
Yeah, that's right. And, yeah, charmed them. But it still didn't work. No,
extraordinary.
How important was John Weller in kind of moving the band forward? Paul's father, who was the manager.
I mean, he was very important in the early days because he would borrow the vans for us. He knew a lot of people in the building trade, so we would borrow vans because we just couldn't afford our own van. So he would do that. He would drive the van. He also would go to lots of the workingmen clubs and get us work. And, you know, he was good with the gab, John was. You know, I mean, he would persuade people to give us the work. So that was brilliant. But, I mean, like us, he didn't have really any knowledge of the music industry, no more than we had, really. So I think when we got signed to Polydor, they really did take control. You know, they said, well, look, this is going to be your agent, this is going to be your solicitor, and this guy's going to be your publisher, and we're your record company. And John quite wisely took the advice from these people. And at that point, he sort of became sort of, not a nanny as such, but he was the man who was still on our side, who represented us. But as for actually managing the band, most of it was done by the record companies. They would tell us where we were touring, the agent would tell us how we were touring, etc., etc. And we had some good people around us, promoters and etc.
Well, we were going to look at some of the... picked up one of the groups you supported, actually, in... this is Peter Cook. Oh, yes. You appeared on Revolver.
Oh, we did.
Dave found this afternoon. This is Peter Cook about to introduce The Jam on a programme called Revolver. Anybody remember that? It was in 1978.
That's Peter Cook's idea of how to brighten up the pop format.
Again, very 70s, as a girl just in a kind of bra sitting on his desk. You know, quite wild, I don't know.
Can you remember that appearance?
No, I think I would, actually. But I don't know.
And you're on the old grey whistle test in 78 too, weren't you?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
How did that go? Who else were you on with? Can you remember?
No, I can't. No. Sorry, it's too long ago for me to remember.
Do all those TV appearances blur from that time? Because you were doing everything, weren't you? You have to single out every, you know, 2 or 3 months or whatever, you know, and it was going to number one. Each one was going to number one. You're spending all your time in TV studios, you must have.
There was no time that we weren't busy doing something or other. We were either touring or recording or doing promotional work like Top of the Pops and this sort of thing. So, yeah, it eventually it did all sort of merge into, you know, especially when you try and think back about specific dates and times and what you were doing, and, you know, that sort of thing becomes a bit of an issue.
Can you remember any of those American tours? Because you went out and, I mean, A, had trouble kind of getting on with America, I think, to some extent, and B, supported, yes, the Blue Oyster Cult. So the idea of the Jam,
you wouldn't
supporting
forget
these,
them, would you?
These hairy gherkins in their kind of flared trousers is absolutely extraordinary, but you did. Yeah. Can you remember anything about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was actually quite frightening because we were at the bottom of the bill and we go out there in our suits, you know, and I swear some of the people, they just didn't used to turn the mics on, or they... You know, because there was like several bands on the bill, And it wasn't really our audience. Some American...
I think this is true, yeah.
Yeah, some of the American promoter decided that it was much better for us to be in front of a hair and teeth audience, even for 30,000 people, than to have anybody out there who was going to bear any relation to what they were getting musically. So it was hard work, you know, because you go on first and nobody took any notice of you at all.
But did America understand at first what the Jam were about, what they represented? It was quite a...
No.
Yeah,
it was not
very,
at all.
It's a very not British concept, wasn't it? Yeah. That's a very concise answer.
I mean, we did a show with Bebop Deluxe, and we had one fan who turned up, and he was at the back dancing, and they threw him out, and we couldn't believe it. I mean, but everybody else, American audiences were very strange. They'd sit down and just watch the bands that were on. But this guy got up and danced, and so one of the security guys just said, well, you can't do that in here, Sonny, and threw him out. You know, it was a real shame. I mean, soon after that, we decided that we'd have to do it the hard way and go back and have our own, do our own tour, even though they were smaller venues and et cetera.
It must have been very difficult because you were so celebrated in Britain, and then you went to America, and it's really hard work. You have to start at the bottom, don't you? Is that very discouraging? Because in Britain, you know, everybody loves you and you can't walk down the street and so forth.
It was a bit strange because, like you say, we success was big in Britain and we were doing some pretty big shows. And then you go off to America and, you know, Knucklesville, Arkansas and places like that and nobody's heard of you, you know, and it's... you just wonder why you're there sometimes, you know. I think if we'd have... broken America, we would have had to have gone to America and stayed there and lived there and then forgotten everything else. And we just weren't prepared to do that. We weren't going to leave. You know, we loved touring Britain and Europe. Although we sort of made tentative moves to play the States, I think most of it was because of contracts rather than actually sort of wanting to go there. I mean, New York was fine and the big towns, big industrial towns were okay. But a lot of the places that we went to, they just didn't get it at all. You know, it's.
We were going to mention this event because I think both Dave and I were there actually, and this is 1978. Is anybody there at Reading Festival 78? Would you remember Sham 69 were on one stage, and then they had the Jam on another stage. They had just a double stage while one band was playing, the other they'd be putting up the equipment, and so you had all the Sham army, and then the kind of broadly mod supporters really for the Jam who met in the middle for the most colossal brawl. In which was actually happened to be the photographer's pit and also where the journalists were. So all the journalists were just brutally beaten up. And happy days. We all had a great time. And what happened was something bizarre happened with Sham. Who did they bring on?
They went on stage with Steve Hillage.
Steve Hillage. And what are the chances of that? Steve Hillage.
Hippie guitarist.
So the guitarist from Gong came on in orange jumps.
Yeah, yeah.
Most Sham 69 fans were not broad-minded, were they, Rick?
In fact, no. Percy gets a bit of not a kicking, but a slight. You make it quite clear you weren't. They were assigned to the same label as you, to Polydor, weren't they? And you weren't enormous admirer of Sham 69's oeuvre.
It's difficult. But I like the guys in Sham because obviously we got to know them quite well. You know what I mean? But it was. We were headlining, I think, at that.
Do you remember? It was a riot, wasn't it? I
mean, yeah, it was. It was. Yeah, nothing to do with us. I don't think it was just. It was just the thing to do in those days, really, just to party, I suppose. That was. You know.
Oh, this is just interesting because this was taken. It was the back cover for actually Smash Hits in December 1983, and I just interviewed a Paul, and it's just interesting. You talk a lot at this stage in the book about what you call his angry young man stance. And when I interviewed him, and this was for Smash Hits, he wanted to talk about Orwell, he wanted to talk about the Spanish Civil War, he wanted to talk about homage to Catalonia, he wanted to talk about communism. It was really interesting. I mean, we let him do it. All credit to Smash Hits, actually. But he really, really, really was accelerated and wound up and had an opinion. You know? So did you see that? Firstly, did you see that developing very fast? And secondly, what was it like to deal with that, to live with that every day for you?
Well, it was great because at that particular time, I think there was a great release for that, because to go on stage and just be really angry, do you know what I mean, was fabulous. You could really sort of, you know, let it out on stage. And I mean, there was a lot of
talking about him being angry there, or you being angry with him, or
It was just a great sort of release, I suppose, to be able to sort of go on stage and just thrash about and make this tremendous noise, you know. I mean, it was always coming down off the adrenaline afterwards, which took a while, you know, or quite a bit to drink as well. And then it was just bang into it the next day as well, you know. But I don't
what about
really
the positions
know
that he took up, you know, his politics and his, you know, he was very aggressive about a lot of other groups too, you know, in the press he was always slagging off in the Argo of the day, the competition.
Yeah.
How did you feel about it?
I think that was, maybe that was an easy stance to take. But it just seems that there was this culture of anger then about everything that was going on that needed sort of shouting about, really. There was strikes and, you know, people being out of work, and you know, there was a lot to be angry about, I think, and I think it because it just gave Paul a voice, really, to express himself in that way. I mean, I was quite calm. I was fine. You know what I mean? I was.
So these are the band's final shows. Yeah, at Wembley. And, you know, how was it communicated to you that the band was breaking up?
Well, I remember we had a sort of break for each of us to go on holiday in 82. And when we came back, we often would book into a studio to do two or three songs, maybe just to get back into the working thing. And I can't remember the name of the studio, but John said, "Oh, we got a meeting. We've got to come and have a, you know, we've all got to sit around this table and have this meeting." And we never had meetings, so this was like alarm bells ringing straight away. You know,
is my theory about bands to interrupt you? They never talk about anything, do they? Is that right? Bands don't have meetings.
No, we don't. No, that's right.
They just let things fester.
I don't know about let things fester. We didn't have time for any of that.
All right, okay.
You know what I mean? It was you're very much told, right, turn up for this, go there, do this. You know what I mean? And which is fine, because a lot of it is to do with what you want to do, which is just go out and play. And so when somebody shuffles you onto a bus and that, you don't really care too much about where you're going, but you know that there's a gig at the end of it. So you tend to sort of, you know, get led about, which is terrific, you know, because your life's not your own.
But nobody, when you're told that Paul wants to leave the group, I'm not even his father thinks it's a good idea. John, the manager, wanted it to carry on. You all wanted it to carry on. So how was that? How did you all react? What did you tell Paul when he told you that?
Well, I think Paul had obviously talked about this to John beforehand, and John had done everything apparently to sort of dissuade him. You know, this is not the thing you should be doing. All the work that we put into this, you know, we all had. John had, record company, everybody, and it was now. We'd actually proved that we were a force to be reckoned with, if you like, musically. We could sell albums, we could sell tours, and we'd established ourselves. And all of a sudden, it was like, right, okay, now we're going to pull, and we're going to stop everything. And it just didn't make sense to anybody. And it was John's baby. He'd sort of been there from the very outset and seen it come up and become successful. And it was a bit of a dream come true in a lot of ways. And then for Paul to suddenly say that he was leaving and that was that, just wasn't right, you know? I mean, he obviously had his reasons, and that's why he wanted, you know, and we were, I think, mature enough to sort of say, okay, well, if that's the way it is, we'll deal with it.
What were those reasons? They were playing a different type of music, presumably?
No. I mean, when we sat down and we had this meeting, and it was really, Paul was saying that he was felt that he was on a treadmill. He felt that, you know, which we were, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was a rather nice treadmill to be on, you know. We were doing everything that we wanted to do, but he felt that, and there was a lot of pressure on Paul to write the songs, to come up with the next single, the next hit, you know, because once you get a number one record, there's nowhere else to go except down, do you know what I mean? It's all right, sort of, and you're sort of judged on those criteria. And we never really felt that that was fair, because we didn't get into the music industry just to have number one records. And that wasn't, although it's a nice sort of marker along the way, it wasn't really the reason. But of course, then you sort of hit that milestone, and then the pressure's on, right? The record company want, your sales have got to go up all the time, and you've got to sell more this time than you did last time. Those sort of pressures are constantly there. There's people making remarks, you know, about your level of success, and you've got to keep going, and more tours, more albums. And of course, the more successful you become, the more people want you out on the road to make money out of you, because the record companies, that's what they're there for. They're there, like any industry, to up their profits and to make as much money as possible. And we never seem to have the strength to turn around and say, whoa, stop, you know, let's just take 6 months out of this, you know, and control it for ourselves. We were literally being dragged along by the whole industry thing. And I think...
That's a really interesting point. So if you had taken 6 months out, do you think it might have carried on? Or do you think
Paul... It was suggested.
That's a really interesting point there.
Bruce suggested it. He said to Paul, look, if you want to stop and go off and do whatever you want to do, you know, solo career or whatever you want to do, you go off and do that, but don't burn all your bridges, you know. And Paul was absolutely adamant that no, not having any of that. It's completely kaput.
But so you've talked a lot about it just now, actually far more in a way than you do in the book, because when you get to that point in the book...
I knew I left something out.
No, just because when the group ends, and it's really touching, the bit where Rick's writing about this last concert and looking, you're playing the drums, you're looking at the set list, and you're just counting these songs down one by one and thinking you're never going to play them again. I mean, it's a very, very, very touching part of the book. But it's interesting, there isn't that much of your emotional reaction in it, because it must have been really devastating. I mean, you've not talked to Paul since, what, 1983, have you? Is that, or not seen him since
1983? That's right, yeah.
That's 32 years or whatever.
Yeah, my maths is terrible, but yeah, if you say so. I mean, myself and Bruce did make every effort to stay in touch with Paul. Me and Bruce stayed in touch. We would, you know, whenever we could, we would meet up. But Paul just seemed to shut the door on that completely, which was a bit of a shame. Because I think... you know, everything had gone well. You know, we'd accepted the fact that, okay, if that was the end of the band, that was the end of the band. But to sort of not to be able to meet up and just to have a cup of coffee or have a chat or something like that just seemed really just very sad and very and a big shame, I think.
So is he absolutely black and white like that? Once he's made his mind up, he's simply moved on and that's it.
Well, we've sort of seen it happen with Girlfriends, and you know, I mean, when Steve Brooks left before we got signed, he decided to leave. That was it. He was out of Paul's life completely for a lot of years. So it was just, I don't know what was driving that particular attitude, but that's the way that he did things. That's the way he saw things, really.
Because we often, Mark and I often talk about bands. We all say, all bands will eventually reform, don't we?
Yeah, I just can't. I can't imagine
the
exception.
Possible.
Well, I'm not holding my breath here. Do you know what I mean?
I can't imagine it's possible not to. You know, can you really go to your grave without getting that a chance to find out what it could have been like if you get back? Because when groups break up, they break up at, well, a huge level. You were playing Wembley Arena. But if they came back 30 years ago, they would be literally 20 times as big. You know, you could tour the world playing stadiums for an indefinite amount of time.
I mean, my view on this has changed a little bit over the years. I think now, because it's been such a long time, and I've seen other bands reform, and it's not really worked for one reason or another. I'm thinking, oh, for God's sake, I'd be like... You know, I do it for the money. Obviously, I do it for the money, but that'd be the only reason.
Which groups are you talking about?
Well, like when Zeppelin did their reform, I know I've got some friends of mine that are big Zeppelin fans, and their expectations of what they were going to go and see was just beyond belief. You know, and when they came back going, wasn't really that good. You know what I mean? The sound was awful, and they didn't play my favourite song, and. You know, and
they weren't 23 anymore. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's half the problem is that their singer couldn't hit the top notes that he could hit when he was 19.
Yeah, so
he didn't want to sing the lyrics he wrote when he was 19 too.
It just seemed like a mistake to reform. I mean, it's, you know, you think, oh, that, but it's, what, you know, easy. All you've got to do is get on stage and do it. You know,
but if Paul were to turn around tomorrow, because I think Paul has actually been, didn't Paul do something with Bruce recently? They're at least talking to each other, aren't they? Am I right?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, I think they bumped into each other at backstage at some in some toilets or something. I don't ask me what they were doing. But,
moving on.
So the ice was almost broken for Paul there. And as much
Paul was to ring tomorrow and say, we think you're doing something in the autumn, I'm sure you'd be keen. And
I think it'd be crazy not to. Yeah, I think you would. I think we would. I mean, I know Bruce would definitely do it. I think I would do it. Because I think it would be silly not to. But whether it's the wisest thing to do is a different story. I don't know. I think a bit of soul searching, but how can you say no? Do you know what I mean? It's like
you absolutely, couldn't you couldn't say no. It would be wrong to say.
Should he say no?
Should he say no? No.
But it's, you know, it's your life. And just one final point. My other theory about bands: A, they don't talk. B, they're all about the drummer. Despite all the propaganda of the people out the front who write the songs, in the end, the drummer is the most difficult member to replace. Do you agree with me, Rick Buckley?
I do.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, Rick Buckley. Yes. We're going to have a slight break, a 10-minute break, so you can get a drink. Rick, unfortunately, his book doesn't actually appear for the next few days, so there are not copies to buy, I'm afraid, are there? His publisher couldn't provide. But it'll be out.
It is out on the 11th of May, and you can pre-order it on Amazon.
And he's probably doing other signings in London. Are you doing other signings in London?
I am, but they're sort of like this sort of thing, but a Q&A, but they've all sold out, unfortunately. So I might arrange some more to do as well, which if you look at strangetown.net, that's where all the Q&As are being advertised for there. So that's strangetown.net.
Thanks very much, Rick Buckley.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.